Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The cost of insulin for type 1 diabetes has nearly doubled over the past 5 years in the U.S. That's according to a new report from the Healthcare Cost Institute, which found the higher price tag has forced many patients and families across the country to ration the life-saving medication. We'll post a link to the report on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us now by phone is the report's lead author and senior institute researcher at the Healthcare Cost Institute in Washington, D.C., Jean Fugelsten-Benick. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Why are the costs rising?
Well, it looks from our data, which is a healthcare claims data, that the prices at the point of sale, so what you pay when you go to the pharmacy, have been increasing across all types of insulin.
Is there any explanation for it? Is it that part of the pharmacy's secret? I mean, they don't have to tell.
No, yeah. So we don't have a lot of transparency into how prices are set. And so that's an area that we definitely, you know, I think we need more information.
We said that it's nearly doubled from kind of from what to what? What are we talking about?
So the average person that has type 1 diabetes was spending about $2,800 a year in 2012. And that's up to about $5,700 a year. And that includes both what their insurance is paying and what they're paying out of pocket.
Yeah, I read a report, I think it was from USA Today, that someone said that, you know, it's one thing if you have a high deductible, then you're pretty much stuck paying for the whole tab.
Definitely in the early part of the year before you hit that deductible. Mm-hmm. But I would also say that we all pay health insurance premiums, and those go to cover the costs that our insurer pays on our behalf. So we all end up being affected when prices go up.
What kind of problems are these higher costs creating? Is there a domino effect?
So we can't speak directly to that in our data. There's been definitely some other work out there. But we do, you know, again, we see that we're spending more on people with type 1 diabetes, both insulin and other types of care. And so I think that can, you know, that's a real challenge for them as well as, you know, everybody more broadly as we figure out how to pay for health care.
What do we know about what insulin does and why you can't mess with your prescription on that?
So insulin is absolutely crucial for people with type 1 diabetes because their pancreas has actually stopped producing this hormone, and it is necessary in order for our bodies to break down blood sugar or the sugar in our blood, and so you have to have it. Otherwise, there can be very serious health consequences.
Is this happening?
Cases.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no problem.
Is this happening across the country?
So we looked at a national level, and so all of our numbers are on average across the nation. We did not look, at specific geographic areas and compare them.
How? And 1.2 million Americans, is it, that have type 1 diabetes that depend on insulin?
Yeah, I think the estimates might even be a little bit higher than that, but that's about right.
So you didn't break it down geographically, but are there any places where lawmakers, executives, state executives are trying to step in and do something about this?
Well, we've definitely seen at the national level that there's interest. There was a hearing last week, two hearings in both the House and the Senate where this issue was raised. And recently, lawmakers have sent letters to the large insulin makers asking them for more details about their pricing.
But we don't know if they've responded.
Well, that letter was just sent, I think, yesterday. So I know we're really eagerly awaiting because that information is definitely valuable.
Is there anything out there helping people struggling with the cost of insulin?
I think there are. I'm not familiar with those programs. It's definitely something that people who are struggling should talk to their doctors about because of the really potential harmful health outcomes. And their doctors can hopefully help them manage through this.
Let's take a call now from Charlotte in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, Charlotte.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. My mother was an insulin-dependent diabetic, and I've got into following this followthemoney.org about what politicians are getting money from where. And I believe Common Cause has a website as well for federal politicians. I don't think you're going to see any kind of price control or accountability for the cost of medicines as long as the pharmaceutical industry is among the top five donors to politicians across the country.
Charlotte, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
You bet. Is there a sense that lawmakers may send out letters and just give this FaceTime, but not actually, I mean, is there much that they can do? The president called last night for reining in prescription costs overall. He didn't, pick out insulin as a particular problem, but we know that Republicans and particularly the Senate aren't interested in that.
Well, we've definitely seen a lot of attention recently, a lot of news articles, and a lot of people's stories being shared, and I think that's definitely helpful, and I'm hopeful that the attention it's getting now will improve the information that's available on how prices are determined.
And by the way, it's not that there is a increased demand for insulin, right?
Definitely not in the population that we studied. People are using just about the same amount as they were 5 years ago.
And so the exact same things are costing twice as much.
Yes, the exact same products, the same active ingredient in the same delivery mechanism, whether it's a vial or a prefilled pen, they all are increasing.
According to an NBC News report, it says that drug makers say they periodically need to raise U.S. list prices of their medications to offset rebates they offer to get them covered by insurance plans. Was there any evidence of that?
So our data looks at the point of sale price, which includes discounts that are negotiated between the manufacturer and the insurers. It does not incorporate those rebates that are provided through separate transactions. However, it's important to remember that people who are in that deductible phase of their benefit or people without insurance are paying these point of sale prices. And we also did a sensitivity looking at if rebates offset 50% of this point of sale price, and it was still a large increase that accounted for the largest share of all of their healthcare spending increase over the period. So I think no matter what, that this is an important issue.
You looked at a 5-year period. Did the increases come at the front end of that 5-year period mostly, or at the back end? Is there a time frame here?
No, it was pretty steady throughout.
So you don't see it, the pharmaceutical companies responding to the pressure from, say, the president and other states such as Ohio to get the prices under control, or there may be legislation?
So we have a lag because the claims data, have to come in and the claims have to be paid. And so our data only went through 2016. So we can't speak right now to if people are responding to the attention, but it's something we will definitely be looking for as we get more data in.
What do people do if they don't have enough insulin?
So it can have, very dire consequences for their health. We've heard a lot of anecdotes about people rationing. We don't speak directly to that in our study because we just can't see that type of information in our data. But hopefully people will speak to their doctors because this is, it can be a life or death situation.
Listeners, if anybody out there is rationing their insulin because of these doubling in the price over the past 5 years, give us a call. Tell us what your story is and how you're managing. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Why did you embark on this study, Jean Fugelsten Benick, for the Healthcare Cost Institute? What triggered it?
Well, so the news reports about people struggling with spending, the attention that it has received recently, we really wanted to look in a systematic and rigorous way at data and at the numbers, and we have the ability to do that. We have one of the largest databases of healthcare claims data, and so we were able to look at a large sample of people with type 1 diabetes and see if we could see evidence that was consistent with the stories that were in the news, and we did.
I don't want to oversimplify it, but type 1 diabetes is usually something genetic. It's something that you have regardless of your lifestyle, right?
Correct. The cause of it is unknown. It often people are often first diagnosed either as children or as young adults. We don't know what the cause is, and there is no cure.
And type 2 diabetes is typically lifestyle related, but they use insulin as well, don't they?
People with type 2 diabetes may or may not use insulin. Mm-hmm. Often they don't start with a medication regime that includes insulin, but as the disease progresses, they often do.
Okay. Let's see. Harold in Columbus, you're on the air with Gene Fugelsten-Bennick. Hi, Harold.
Hi. In Ohio, we had all these issues with the drug middleman.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember what they called it.
Yeah.
The managers. How much of that has to do with these price increases? Are you looking at just what the drug companies charge, or are you looking at the
point of sale? Right.
Point of sale charge.
So you're looking at point of sale.
So I'll take it off air.
Yeah. Okay, Harold. Thanks. Thanks for the call. Is there any sense that middleman, those pharmacy benefit managers, are part of this equation?
Yes. So I think that is the area where there are the largest questions. The pharmacy benefit managers do negotiate rebates with manufacturers and with insurers based on the quantity of certain products. And if they hit certain thresholds, there are rebates that are provided. But we don't have any information on that. And so that is an area where more transparency is needed to really understand what's going on with these prices and to hopefully, keep them in check.
And as far as the transparency issue goes, Gene, what is anybody in Congress calling for more transparency instead of just trying to control the prices? How about understanding and controlling our access to the understanding of how things are priced?
Yes. Yeah, so the letter I mentioned earlier speaks directly to that and asks for that information specifically, which is why I think I am hopeful that we will finally shed some light on the details of those transactions.
Let's see. We've got Anthony in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, Anthony.
Hello. I was just calling because I take a prescription insulin
mm-hmm.
for quite a few years. It costs around $1,500 a month without insurance, and there is types that you can get from if you have your doctor prescribe it from Walmart. They sell a insulin that's around $37 a month. I just want people to know it's an option to keep you from rationing it and ended up causing medical problems for yourself.
Have you tried to ration?
I have had to do that in the past, and it's really hard. You end up with high blood sugar. You may end up in a hospital, and it's going to cost a lot more to treat you there than it would to have some type of help with your,
Yeah, that's a good point. Gene Fugelsten-Bennick, is there any, did you take a look at what the ancillary costs are of rationing?
We have not. We are embarking on more research looking at outcomes in hospitalizations for people with diabetes to see what those trends look like. And hopefully that may shed some light on some of these, other aspects of care for individuals with diabetes.
Okay. Well, Gene Fugelsten-Bennick, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Gene Fugelsten-Bennick is the lead author of the report that we're talking about. She's a senior institute researcher at the Healthcare Cost Institute in Washington, D.C., and we'll have a link to that report on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Healthier eating is becoming a national priority in the U.S. Professor of Nutrition at Tufts University in Massachusetts, Gerald Mand, recently co-wrote an article for The Conversation about why it's time the country started looking at food as medicine. We'll post a link to it on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Gerald Mand joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Ann, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for your interest in the issue.
You wrote that healthier eating is becoming a national priority. How are you distinguishing that?
Well, what we wrote is that we're in a nutrition crisis, and that people are facing in their daily lives, particularly through rising healthcare costs. But we also wrote that as a result of that pressure, the Congress and others are beginning to take steps to address it.
Such as?
Well, in the last Congress, of course, there was a farm bill, which happens every 5 years, but they took significant steps in that farm bill to improve nutrition, particularly among the SNAP program, which is the food stamp program. But also they created a new work group that they call Food is Medicine, which is an effort to look at food to help bring down healthcare costs. They also instructed the government accounting office, the office that oversees government, to look at how nutrition is being addressed and to report on how it could be better done.
Are we talking about healthier eating kind of holistically, or are we talking about eating and food as a kind of medicine?
Well, I think there's a need and an opportunity for both. And so I think most people want to eat a healthier diet. There's a, probably record high interest in doing that. But people also have busy, complicated lives. And so often the meal choices they make are whatever the easiest choices are. So I think for a long time as a country, when we see people who have less healthy diets that end up being overweight or sick because of their diets, we feel that it's somehow their fault, their lack of willpower, not taking responsibility. But increasingly, science has recognized that it's the food, toxic food environment, and that by changing that environment, by making healthier food choices the easier choice, people will eat healthier diets. But also, and as you noted, food is medicine, because so many people are sick with advanced disease that are diet-related. We're also pushing, separately from improving everyone's diet, on how nutrition can be used as a form of medicine to treat people with advanced disease and get better outcomes.
You know, you mentioned the SNAP program and how they're changing that and tweaking that to reflect this better, higher regard for food is and the healthiness of food. But one of the proposed amendments to the Farm Bill included pilot testing for medically tailored meals. It was rejected, as you noted in your piece for The Conversation. It sounds like Congress isn't ready to cross that Rubicon.
As the year began, we were, and the Farm Bill began, it, for those who advocate in this space, I work for President Obama on these issues, it was tough with a Republican president, Republican House and Senate. We were more concerned that there'd be cuts and rollbacks on the progress we had made in those 8 years with Michelle Obama's leadership. And that didn't happen. And we were actually able to make some progress in some areas. So we didn't get as much as we wanted. Mm-hmm. It would have been nice to see pilots for medically tailored meals, which, but there's that is a more costly intervention. But we were able to get other provisions in SNAP, such as the produce prescription. So that cost less money. They were taking that step. So we're making progress, but there's plenty of work to do, and we hope to make more progress this year.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about food and how it fits in as a national priority for health. My guest is Gerald Mand. He's a professor of nutrition at Tufts University. He and two of his colleagues wrote a piece for The Conversation. It's entitled Food is Medicine, How U.S. Policy is Shifting Toward Nutrition for Better Health. If you have a question or comment for Jerry Mand, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You highlighted diet-related diseases and death rates in your article. Tell us about those. What about death rates?
Yeah, I think, you know, the nation really does face a very stark nutrition crisis that's underappreciated. I think what most people see in their daily lives is that their health care costs are going up. So when you look at health care premiums, out-of-pocket expenses, they're going up. When you ask, when you start looking into it and saying, well, what's driving this, it's that Americans are less healthy. We had always sort of took for granted that each generation would live a longer, healthier life than the previous generation, and that's happening in other countries, but not in our country, unfortunately. And the reason for that is poor quality diets. And, for example, we have a partnership, John Hancock Life Insurance here in Boston came to us because they recognized in their own life insurance business that people are living a shorter, less healthy lives, and that's costing them money as a business. When they did a deep dive into why that was happening, you know, tobacco, exercise all matter, but 2-to-1, they found it's poor diets that are really causing people to live less healthy and lives and live shorter lives.
How do Medicare for older Americans and Medicaid for low-income Americans factor in to this equation?
Well, they're the payers of health care, and so they have an enormous impact on which health care services are being provided. And today, nutrition status is not even part of the medical record. The new electronic health record that we all have doesn't even have a vital sign for measuring what people's diets are. And as a result, it doesn't get attention. We've known for a long time physicians are rarely trained about nutrition, so it's not one of the areas that they're great at helping at either.
Yeah.
Go on. No, I was saying, and so when you look at the rising healthcare costs being driven principally by poor diets, you see that our healthcare system has historically not been designed to address that problem.
What do we know about why physicians are not better trained in the effects of nutrition or lack thereof on health?
Well, it's not as much a part of the curriculum as it needs to be. That needs to change. It needs to be part of the exams that they're given because that drives a lot of what they're trained. But also, you know, often I will say, though, that physicians' first priority is often to deal with the most things that are urgently life-threatening that might kill you in the next few minutes if mm-hmm. they're not acted upon. And so as a result, diet, which rarely poses that type of risk unless you're choking, is something that, you know, the effects take often years to have. And as a result, it's put off as a priority. But eventually, those issues come home to roost as they have, and we're not addressing them.
Can you go into a little bit more detail about the produce prescription program, that new federal program that you mentioned? It allows doctors to prescribe fruit and vegetable purchases to patients. How does it work?
Well, it's going to be piloted in this project, so but it is out there today, and so they're going to look at it a little bit more in detail and come up to figure out what's the best way to do it. But the way it works is just as it sounds. You know, today you visit the doctor, and they can easily pick up their pad and write you a prescription for a drug if you need that for your illness. But if the doctor is sitting there and realizes that this drug might help treat some of the symptoms, but the real cause is your poor diet, this is a way to make it easier to sort of address that directly. And so if people should be eating more fresh fruits and vegetables than they are, putting it on a prescription pad and handing it to the patient can be the first step of making that happen, particularly when you tie it then to incentives that actually help people buy that produce at a lower price.
Okay, so yeah, you put it on a prescription pad and then I bring that prescription to my grocer?
excuse me.
Yeah.
No, you could bring it to, hold on one second.
Yeah, sure. Take your time.
So we already have something with the SNAP program. So with farmers markets, we've now had for the last 5 years a produce incentive program that's been tested and showed to work. So you can go up to your farmers market. You can show that you are in SNAP and that you'd like to participate in this incentive program. And they'll give you actually extra a coupon or add to it so that you can take 20 or 30 cents off the price, 20 or 30% off the price. So for those that would participate in the pilot would do the exact same thing. And I mentioned before, John Hancock, we're doing with that with them right now. So for those who take their life insurance product called Vitality, when they go to the store, they can swipe their card, their loyalty card with the food store that they shop at, and they'll see 20 or 30% taken off the produce price because they participate in this product that they have, Hancock Vitality. Under this pilot, it will be expanded for others, low-income people who participate in the prescription produce. So for the doctors who participate in it, in the pilots, they'll be able to write it on that scrap of paper. They'll be able to bring that to their a local store or farmer's market that are participating, depending on how the pilot's designed, and will get a discount of 20 or 30% on the produce that they buy.
What about the school lunch? I know that some districts are working really, really hard to make them healthier, but then kids don't eat them as much. I mean, what about school lunches, after school, before school meals, that kind of a thing? How can they play a role in responding to this?
Well, that's a great point, and they can play probably one of the most important roles. Because if you look at the population as a whole and how people eat and your own experience, I know I've experienced it, and you may have changing the way you eat in a substantial way and also changing your weight once you get older is very hard. Learning to eat right to begin with is a lot easier. And so this has been shown over and over again. And the great news is we have as a country, as we try to solve this problem, we're in great shape in that the U.S. Department of Agriculture, where I had worked before coming to Tufts, over half the infants in the United States are fed through a program called WIC, Women, Infant, Children. A third are fed through child care, where USDA sets the standards. And virtually all of our kids in school, both public and private, in fact, from kindergarten through 12th grade are have the opportunity to get all of their food for school, and a great number get all of their daytime food from school. By making those meals healthier, we can change that, and relatively quickly. When the program first went into effect, there was some grumbling from older students, seniors, juniors, who had been eating one way, and all of a sudden it's a shift, so you can see why that's a change for them. But what we saw for the younger kids starting at kindergarten who just receive meals that are healthier to begin with, it's something that just becomes part of their life. And actually, they enjoy it even more. I think study after study and experience shows if you expose kids to fresh fruits, vegetables, other healthy foods, they're delicious foods. There's no sacrifice. Unfortunately, as a country, sometimes we feel that, gee, eating healthier means making sacrifices. There's no when you experience that, you're eating at the wrong place or getting the wrong people involved. There's no reason that the healthier choice isn't also the most delicious choice. And we're working on that. There's a school in Connecticut, New London, a group called Brigade, one of the top chefs in the country, Dan Giusti, is there, chose to switch his career there. And he's basically shown that by providing healthier food as the more delicious food, kids will love it.
There's something in your policy recommendations in your in the piece for the conversation that I wanted to ask you about. In the section where it says integrating nutrition into healthcare, we've already talked about that, including in the electronic health record, as you mentioned, and we talked about medical education. You say, and risk-sharing arrangements that incentivize providers to improve the health of their communities. What are you talking about there?
Sure. Well, one of the big changes that has occurred because of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is groups called Accountable Care Organizations, or ACOs. And what those are, they're springing up in all of our communities, if we've known it or not. But basically what it's looking at is the Affordable Care Act tackled as its first problem is how do we get more people health care? And so by having more people get insurance and making it available, that was job one. But job two that it also tried to address is how do you bring down the cost of healthcare? And these ACOs, or accountable care organizations, are critical in that it requires that providers come together and figure out ways that they can provide care for less money. And so, in a sense, they share the risk of the cost. And so they can come together and they can figure out if we take this step or that step, we'll be able to provide health care for less, and they can share in the savings that they get. So the government has set up a program so that groups, provider groups, all come together. They form a broader group, and the government's going to pay you a certain amount of money for care more broadly. And if you can deliver it for less, you get to keep a lot more of the extra money. And if you can't, then you share the risk. And so that's a system we're moving toward. Nutrition has the chance to play a big role in that, and is through programs like medically tailored meals that we talked about, for example. So what that new system will do is, in these risk-sharing ACO accountable care systems, they will have the incentive to look to say, well, how do we save money? And as we've been talking the last bit, diet's a big part of that. So they're going to inevitably come back to saying, you know, there's just, if we're really going to hold down healthcare costs, you know, it has to be that fewer people become sick. And the only way to get to that is through better diets, when so much of our healthcare costs today, heart disease, the number one driver is poor diet, and cancer. Poor diet is passing tobacco as the leading cause of cancer. And so that program of risk sharing will lead payers and providers of healthcare to look to nutrition as a way to hold down costs. And we're ready with tools to help them do that.
And do you think the nation's ready with a kind of for a cultural shift on this score?
I think a lot of people are. I think that, you know, the challenge is that food companies are the problem often, and some have stepped forward to be the solution, and not enough have. You know, earlier in my career, I worked on tobacco regulation. The tobacco companies were the problem, and the solution was putting them out of business, essentially. Food's very different. We all eat. It's an important part of life. And so food companies are often the problem, but need to be the solution as well. Some are stepping forward to do that, but many need to do that. And I think what we're seeing in the marketplace is that consumers are certainly ready for it. So, for example, soft drink consumption is steadily declining, and that's sending a message to the food companies, but unfortunately it's still too much of diets.
Is it helping? Are we seeing any difference in the fact that there's more labeling in fast food restaurants?
You know, we will, and that's a great point to raise that, because people often look at that and you might read a story saying, well, it's just not changing what people buy. And it will for some people, for those who are looking at it. I think it comes as a shock when you see something on the menu that provides 1,000 calories. I know, as a trained nutritionist, I can't guess ahead of time accurately how many calories are in different dishes and restaurants, because I don't know how they prepared them. But more important, what people don't often focus on right away, which is working on labels, as I've had throughout my career, is that the target of labels is the consumer to a degree, but the primary target is actually the producer of the food. And so the real change we'll see in restaurants, and we have seen this where the labeling is in effect, is that companies aren't going to put an item on their menu that has over 1,000 calories. So not only does the menu labeling allow people to make better choices themselves, those who choose to, but it puts a lot of incentive and pressure on companies to produce healthier options as well, because they know the less healthier ones won't sell as well.
Well, Jerry Mann, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
And great to have you take this topic up. It was a pleasure to enjoy be with you, and I hope we can do it again sometime.
I do, too. That's Jerry Mann, professor of nutrition at Tufts University. He helped write a piece for The Conversation about the increasing priority and why healthier eating is becoming a national priority. So we'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll have more Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The idea of being heart sick or sick with grief or heartbroken can affect our body and our brain. University of Maryland neurologist Dr. Lisa Shulman recently wrote about it in her new book titled Before and After Loss, A Neurologist's Perspective on Loss, Grief, and Our Brain. We post a link to it on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Dr. Shulman joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Ann. Thank you for inviting me on.
You know, the ideas of heartache and all of that kind of thing have been around forever. It feels like it hurts when your heart's broken. It hurts physically when somebody you love dies, that kind of a thing. But you're suggesting that there are larger, deeper, broader ramifications of that hurt.
Yes, no, I think that we've used those sorts of metaphors for years. When I experienced my own personal loss, and that was the death of my husband a few years ago, I found that the experience of loss and grief was very different than I'd expected. I guess I'd anticipated it being profound sorrow, but it had a lot more to do with disorientation and a fog of confusion. And so that led me down a path of doing research to understand what is the impact of loss and emotional trauma on the brain. And what I found was an incredible amount of information that, as a neurologist, I think I was very surprised I didn't already know about how traumatic loss causes changes in the brain and changes, in fact, throughout the body, including the heart, as you said.
What did you see in your research?
Well, you know, I think many of us are quite acquainted with the phenomena of fight or flight when we are encountering a acute and threatening trauma, like encountering a bear on a hike. What happens after traumatic loss and grief is a period of chronic stress, you know, not something that acutely causes a feeling of threat, but instead, a sense of threat that goes on for weeks, months, and potentially even years. And actually, the brain has the capacity, importantly, to adapt very quickly to protect us from threats. So many of the things that the brain does is protective and to ensure our survival. And that involves many things, but part of it is the concept of neuroplasticity, which is a fancy word for simply saying that the neural connections, the neural circuitry and pathways are remodeled based on our experiences, both bad experiences and good experiences. In fact, those sorts of changes occur even start in within minutes and hours, but then become more and more frozen in potentially a bad mode where we feel threatened and hypervigilant both by night and by day, and that can go on unless we take steps to reverse it.
You talk about emotional traumatic brain injury in the book, and I'm wondering what would cause something like that, what you mean by it, what would cause it?
Yes, no, I introduced that new phrase in the book, and, you know, the point behind that is that we, in basically, whether we're talking about medicine or psychology, we have pretty much splintered off the idea of loss and emotional trauma from what we commonly talk about as physical traumatic brain injury. But I think that there's really a more overlap than we have given credit to it. In particular, now that we recognize concussion as being an important form of traumatic brain injury, albeit a mild form of traumatic brain injury, we see in people who have had concussions, and that's where, you know, very often we hear about that in sports, where there is a alteration of consciousness and it's transient, and the person goes back to their baseline function. And in fact, if you did an MRI or you examine them carefully, after a bit of time, you might not be able to find a single thing. And people who have had multiple concussions begin to experience problems with their memory, with their mood, with their learning, with their sleep. And that is so very similar to the experience of loss and grief.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dr. Lisa Shulman. We're talking about the topic of her new book. It's titled Before and After Loss, A Neurologist's Perspective on Loss, Grief, and Our Brain. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Shulman, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Talk about broken heart syndrome and what you mean by that and how much it can affect a person.
Well, the broken heart syndrome is a very well-known medical phenomenon. And, you know, basically, just in the situation I was mentioning, when somebody is experiencing chronic stress over time, there's the brain is responding in a way to marshal the forces of the body in order to protect itself. And that involves the brain actually kicking off a whole range of hormones and inflammatory mediators that are circulating throughout our body and causing many, many systemic changes, among them the potential for changes in the heart rate and heart movements. And so when somebody actually has these changes of heart movements, this can cause typical symptoms of a heart attack. In most cases, fortunately, this just reverses without any permanent damage. But there can actually be times where there is an actual heart attack, or also known as a myocardial infarction. And so this is, to the public, is known as broken heart syndrome, but it goes by another name, Takotsubo cardiomyopathy. So it is a medical condition.
Yeah, you said that it's been well known for years, and I always thought it was just sort of that old wives kind of tale sort of a thing.
No, that's really what the importance, I think, of what I learned about the experience of emotional trauma, that oftentimes we've thought that these are, you know, just sort of what we expect, kind of a period of grieving, but we haven't really reckoned with the actual changes in the brain and the body.
Another thing that we don't often hear a scientist, someone like you talk about, is the hidden messages in dreams. And I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit, that that's, again, our brain helping us sort things out in an unconscious state.
Yeah, you know, I find it, as a physician, interesting and somewhat odd that dreams just seem to have some sort of a mystique or stigma. In my own field, we oftentimes talk about people who are having problems with vivid dreaming and difficult dreams and so forth, but we don't actually generally talk about the function of dreams and how it has all this healthy function. A healthy functioning requires dreaming, and what dreams do for us is that it actually takes our experiences from the daytime, and then at nighttime while we sleep, all these experiences are being, it's called consolidated, and it's kind of like filing all these experiences into our past memories and reconnecting them with this huge file system of past memories, such as if you had seen a movie last night, then it would go in a file to connect it with previous movies that were like this and so forth. But when we experience significant loss and emotional trauma surrounding all sorts of kinds of losses in life, those difficult memories and emotions can be too traumatic to be filed and connected with previous memory. And that results in them just being left there in the subconscious, not ever being integrated into our previous experience, such that we have increasingly disturbing dreams by night and disturbed sleep and ruminations and intrusive thoughts by day. So in fact, utilizing a dream journal and recording your dreams is an important tool to connect with the very kinds of symbols that are important to try to surface or reconnect with material that is causing exactly the trouble that that we want to learn about.
Do men and women experience grief differently in a physical way?
Physically, I've done a lot of review of research, and I haven't seen differences in physical changes.
Mm-hmm.
But I have seen that there are different modes of coping. And, you know, there is a tendency for men, males, you know, this isn't always the case, but just saying in a generalizable way that men tend to be sort of more concrete and problem solving, and women tend to gravitate more to various kinds of emotional explanations. And in one particular study that I recall that's in the book, there were two different interventions, and one was more a concrete problem-solving intervention, and one was more of an emotional intervention. And the hypothesis was that the men would benefit more during their grief from this problem-solving approach, the women from more the emotional approach. And the result of the study was exactly the opposite, that it was very interesting to find that what we use generally to cope, that we end up getting more benefit from a new and innovative approach to our own grief.
We're just about out of time, but I kind of wanted to ask you about the sources of grief. You know, you talked about it in losing your spouse a few years ago, and a lot of times it's about loss, but it can be the loss of a relationship. It could be the loss of a job, that kind of thing too, right?
Absolutely. There's no reason to believe that there's anything singular about one particular type of loss. And instead, I think each of us has to think about what is the personal meaning and impact of that particular loss, whether it is, as you say, the death of a loved one, or it could be some sort of significant loss of work or a financial reversal. Mm. All these things could cause the same effects.
Dr. Lisa Shulman, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome, and thank you so much for having me on.
You bet. Dr. Lisa Shulman, her new book is titled Before and After Loss, A Neurologist's Perspective on Loss, Grief, and Our Brain. Thanks for listening today. It's been Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.